I'm standing on Highway 666, running through towns like Cortez, Shiprock, Sheep Springs, and ending in Gallup, New Mexico. To some, a beautiful stretch of the American landscape, but to Mickey and Mallory Knox, who are still at large, it is literally a candy lane of murder and mayhem.
Baby, I've been waiting night and day. I didn't see the time.
Do a, wow. If you're doing the intro, do a We Hold Movies Hostage joke.
We Hold Movies Hostage?
Right?
Yeah, this is Rut and Rewind, yeah. A podcast that holds, yeah, we hold them hostage here on this podcast. Well, yeah, we're the point. Mickey and Mallory of podcasting.
That's what we are.
I rescued you from your abusive daughter so that we could make a podcast. You coming with me? Don't worry, we're going to be stars. Would Mickey and Mallory have a podcast today?
No, but they'd have a
TikTok.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. They probably would, yeah, because they'd have to be, it's so on the frenetic. Go. They'd probably make an appearance on like Red Scare though. Yeah, we are that podcast. We are that bitch. Welcome back. I'm Max
Rue. Who are you?
I'm Max Rue.
You're Max Rue. I'm Courtney Peronto.
That's right.
We're here with a returning guest. Second time.
He was just here. Yeah. He couldn't stay away from Oliver Stone.
I had to come back. I saw this movie and I said, damn. Yeah, lot to talk about here.
Yeah.
Literally one of my least favorite filmmakers.
Yeah.
Alive today.
Not a huge fan.
Okay.
Alex Culpin. Yeah. A more talented filmmaker and writer than Oliver Stone.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Put that on your LinkedIn.
I know where Courtney stands on Oliver Stone. We know that.
Listen, I'm looking at his filmography. I'm going to find something I like.
Look, he has made
movies for a long time.
He has made movies for a long time. He has made 20 movies. He's made documentaries. He tried to normalize Putin, I think, at one point.
He had a sit-down interview with him and like tried to show him some Stanley Kubrick film, if I'm not mistaken.
Right? And he was like, he's not that bad.
For real?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think that there maybe is a filmmaker out there that could make an interesting movie about Russian propaganda, like sold to us from like American anti-Russian propaganda, I think could be interesting. It doesn't mean that I think Putin is a good person by any means.
When did he do that?
I want to say it must have been around the time that Trump got elected, right? Yeah, let's see, 2017.
Okay.
Oliver Stone, though, I mean, came about, he wrote Scarface. He wrote a few movies before he started directing. He wrote Scarface. He wrote Midnight Express, which I have not seen in a very long time. He wrote a movie called Year of the Dragon that we talked about recently, which...
Is that the Michael Cimino film?
That is the Michael Cimino film. He wrote a Hal Ashby movie that I watched recently because I was considering recommending it for the series. 8 Million Ways to Die, which I believe is his last movie. It is one of the most coke-fueled disasters you can imagine. It's Hal Ashby basically making an 80s crime movie with Jeff Bridges and Roseanne Arquette. And you can feel the presence of cocaine in the movie. It's not very good, but I definitely would be down to talk about it on the podcast because it's kind of insane, especially that it's Hal Ashby.
I don't dislike Wall Street.
I haven't seen Wall Street in a long time. I don't know how to... I couldn't really say how I feel about Wall Street.
I've never seen it, but the only Oliver Stone movie that I feel like really stood out to me that I enjoyed was Talk Radio, and I think that's because it's super contained, and it's also kind of quiet, only 90 minutes as well. He's not like flexing the whole time, and it's not like super muscular. Like it's restrained by his measures for sure.
Right.
I always forget that he wrote
part of The Doors where it's like right before Jim Morrison dies, he's recording and he stops recording and he goes, "Let's get some tacos." And then text comes over the screen that says that he died right after that. And I do find it adorable.
We'll cover The Doors at one point because it is.
Yeah, we have to, unfortunately.
Movies. Well, I feel like that's the problem with all of his movies. He has like great scenes, but as a whole, once you get done with it, you're like,
oh, I don't think that was supposed exhausting. To be good. Oh, we've also covered W on this podcast. Which, it's the George
is it
W.
funny
Bush.
At least?
No, it's kind of a slog.
Brolin's funny in it. I mean, look, I still go on record as I think JFK is a masterpiece.
I knew,
JFK. I think it's incredible. I think that's the most well-suited his style has ever been for a movie.
I'd be curious to revisit Any Given Sunday, mostly for Miss Diaz's outfit.
Any Given Sunday on this podcast.
It's so long, though.
It's really long.
I remember seeing it on TV. Like, I don't think I've ever watched in full, but it used to be on TV. I feel like every single day when I was a kid.
I bet you anything, there's a really good like hour and 45 minute movie in that movie somewhere.
There's an extended sequence where Jamie Foxx and Al Pacino are having lunch at Al Pacino's house, and mm-hmm. it keeps cutting back to Spartacus playing on the TV in the background. So the whole scene is intercut with Spartacus.
Loves those juxtapositions.
It's pretty crazy. I think Born on the 4th of July is actually very good. Mostly because okay. Cruise is great.
I like
in
it.
I think I would say like JFK, Born on the 4th of July.
I would say Wall Street's my favorite.
Okay. I'll rewatch it. I do think Platoon is good, but I haven't seen it in a while.
I also think that Wall Street influences things that I might kind of like, where something like the movie that we're going to talk about, like some of his other things, JFK, which is, I admit, is like probably technically good. I don't enjoy it. I think influence things that I find obnoxious.
His like passion for, I think, uncovering the truth behind that is something that I think is probably his most noble and actually strong it's cause that he's put forth as a filmmaker. I haven't seen Alexander. I would watch it though.
I would watch it for Colin Farrell.
Yeah. I really want to see Salvador. I hear that one's pretty good.
Oh yeah, that's James. Okay. The James Wood. Yeah.
I did see The Savages in theaters, and it might be one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life.
That's probably his worst movie.
I think it's his worst movie, and I think it is just like one of the worst movies.
It's horrible.
It's horrible. Absolutely. Blake Lively should have, sued him for. Yeah.
I don't know why, but I always confuse that movie with that Cormac McCarthy adaptation that.
Counselor?
Oh, The Counselor.
Yeah, The Counselor. I don't know why.
The Counselor rips.
They came out about a year apart, and they have similar posters, and they're kind of like.
Yeah, they have similar posters.
Border.
They're both bleak.
Thrillers. Yeah. But Savages is like, it's just horrible. Wall Street Money Never Sleeps is bad.
Never saw that.
World Trade Center is bad.
Oh, I saw that in theaters with my parents. When I was like 8 or whatever that came out, I was like, this is trash.
It's a bad. This is garbage. It's not a good movie. Wait, how old are you?
Yeah. 29. Thank you for, okay.
No, you were not. You were.
When did it come out?
When were you born?
So it was 92. When did it come out? 2006. So it was maybe 13, 14.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was like, hold on. There's no way. I actually have always been curious about Nixon. I've heard good things about it. His Nixon movie with Hopkins. And then Heaven and Earth is one that I always forget exists with Tommy Lee Jones.
I think that's
probably one of his most like forgotten early 90s movies.
Okay.
He made it in between JFK and Natural Born Killers.
Did you see Snowden?
No, I've heard Snowden.
That seems like one that
horrible?
You would like maybe watch alone. Like that seems like
I probably would have watched it if it wasn't Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
That's what I thought.
There's just nothing
yeah.
about that sounds interesting to me.
It just seems like a movie that I would get like a weird text in the middle of the day, just being like, just watch Snowden.
Well, just checked in with Snowden. Yeah, not bad. Nick Cage is in it, you know.
I think that like yes, I don't like him as a filmmaker. But also I think that he seems really annoying. Like he seems sure. like someone in high school that was like on the speech and debate team.
He joined the war in Vietnam. Like he willfully went there. He was a rich kid who signed up for the war in Vietnam, which has always made his like career path and like his politics very dubious, I think. Huh. I would have liked to have researched that more. But yeah, he is a rich kid who wanted to go to Vietnam.
How's he rich? Like
his dad's a stockbroker. His parents met in World War II. I don't know what his mom did. She says she's French. But his dad was a stockbroker. He's got big boomer energy for sure.
He is the kind of guy that would come into my work and like I'd be like, okay, he's actually pretty nice and he's spending money. I don't hate him. And then once he's like 3 glasses of wine in, he would like let me know that like he'd been to Korea.
That third glass always gets you.
It happens.
Who is he married to? Because I could see him being married to an Asian woman.
Me too. That's also what I was thinking, but I didn't want to say it, but yeah, he's like my wife.
Oh, he was married to 2 Asian women.
Wow.
Not one, but 2.
2. Yeah, he's got some Asian wives. Okay, this all checks out. Signed up for the Vietnam War, has Asian wives. Oh, we left out one Stone movie that I actually have a soft spot for. It's not a good movie, but I think it's kind of a trashy
this
fun
one?
Movie. U-Turn.
Oh, that's Oliver Stone?
Yeah.
Honestly, with Sean Penn and Jennifer Lopez.
If that was like his lane, I think I would appreciate him more.
He's still in the Natural Born Killers mode, but he's making this really like gross neo-noir. It's like Jennifer Lopez cucking Nick Nolte with Sean Penn.
The fact that Nick Nolte and Jennifer Lopez are even together in the first place is a win for Nick Nolte. So you should just like accept
it. Good rash. Yeah, Joaquin is great in it.
I guess my thing is like, I don't understand why he is a director of of that like generation of directors that has somehow like rose to be a prestigious director and other people weren't. Like, I'm like, I don't know. He's fine.
Let's get into Natural Born Killers, because I think it's, when was the last time you guys had seen it?
College.
I had never seen it, which is crazy to me.
That's amazing that you went this long without seeing Natural Born Killers.
Yeah.
As a young white man who likes movies.
I was a kid who had a Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas poster in their bedroom and a Pulp Fiction poster. Like, this should have been something I saw when I was like 16. And I probably would have liked it a lot more if I was that age.
Yeah.
I saw it, or even younger.
That's funny that you brought that up, because what I got in a conversation with my friends about after I saw this movie is like, of the college dorm room movie posters, because it's like Boondock Saints, mm-hmm. Reservoir Dogs, this.
Well, what's interesting too is that Quentin Tarantino apparently wrote the story for this, and then Oliver Stone and two other writers made a screenplay for it.
Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino completely disowned the film.
We will definitely get into that. That's a big one for sure.
I like cautiously appreciate Quentin Tarantino. Like, I definitely like him a lot more than I do Oliver Stone. And like, when I read that, I was like, I just immediately gave him credit for all the things I liked in the movie.
I think that the things that are good about it are probably obviously outside of like some of the visual stuff that like we can get into with Robert Richardson. Yeah, I mean, this is a movie that came out the same year as Pulp Fiction, 1994. Even though Reservoir Dogs came out 2 years before, this was, you know, kind of the big coming out party for Tarantino. It was this whole year. He wins Cannes with Pulp Fiction. He wins an Oscar for Best Screenplay. Natural Born Killers, even though it doesn't get awards attention, is a pretty monumental movie at the time. I remember talking to my brother when I was younger, and this, it was like this and Kids were the movies that like, when he was a teenager, everybody was trying to sneak into to go see. Everybody wanted to see Natural Born Killers and Kids.
Yeah, I was talking to my friend who was, I think, 14 when the movie came out and saw it, and she was saying to me, like, this was like the movie you'd see if you wanted to be edgy. Kids was definitely the other movie that came to mind just in that realm.
Well, I think
wonder if I would have a different experience with it if I would have ever seen it in the theaters, because like, it's really hard to surrender to.
It's a lot.
I also think it's really top heavy.
It's a whole lot of movie.
So which I think is like its strength at times.
It's its strength and its Achilles heel. It's definitely, it's one of those movies that I completely understood not only like why it was so big when it came out, why it was so groundbreaking at the time, why obviously it was like a piece of the culture that everybody was talking about. I understand why I liked this movie when I was a teenager. I don't hate this movie. It's one of those things where I'm just like, like, I understand every stage that you could go through of liking or hating this movie. I completely understand all of it.
I think it's all valid. That it's upper tier Stone.
Yeah.
But like, is there another phase of this movie where like you're a father someday and your kid's 15 and like really into this movie and then you hate it more than you ever thought you could?
You little shit, you'll never like this. Stop watching it now.
Yeah.
And it's time we watch Natural Born Killers together.
Maybe by that time it would be quaint if like whatever the next.
Well, the
Zoomer.
Funny thing is that it does kind of feel quaint now in a way. Like it's so aggressive and trying to shock you that by today's standards of how numb we are. And
yeah. We've seen like everything now, and like the movie is genuinely prophetic. I feel like even during the time that it came out and now, like the movie, it's funny that we mentioned like TikTok earlier, because the movie, the way it's edited, is just completely unpredictable. And like the attention span that like you have to have for this movie is like very minimal. Like if you show this to a kid who's like, I've never seen a movie in my life, I hate movies, and you like throw this on for him, he'll be like, oh shit,
who is this kid? I hate
who is this kid? Yeah, like I think it'd be fun to like do a movie inspired by this that like the protagonists were on TikTok and constantly doing TikTok dances.
I think that there have been movies that have tried to like tap into that. There was a movie that came out that I never saw called Spree.
Oh yeah, it wasn't that
Joe
good.
Carey from Stranger Things, and it's all about like
I like that guy.
He's like a Uber driver or something who goes on a killing spree, but he's filming all of it.
That movie has a similar problem to this one where like the satire just becomes so trying after a while because it's so blunt and obvious. Right.
Well, I guess that's like a big thing too, is like, I guess between like this movie and obviously there's been a whole new wave of class satires that have come out in the last few years that I think are all like pretty blunt in their own way, or at least are like criticized for being really blunt. And there's this question of like, can anybody do satire anymore? It's hard to say, because it's like the ones that endure, I could also see feeling really obvious at the time, because like in the 90s, there was movies like Natural Born Killers, To Die For and Scream, that were all these kind of critiques of that were very like meta and critiquing media that all felt very, very, they were all kind of having a very similar conversation. Yeah, Gone Girl. But Gone Girl, I think, endures.
Gone Girl to me feels like the next step after To Die For. And in a way, like this movie also reminded me of Gone Girl. Like my favorite thing about Gone Girl, like to spoil two movies that are fucking old, is that like they both are about these stories that like captivate us. And, you know, usually in these stories, we have to like kill the protagonist. But like, I like them both because like we let them live. I really like the first act of this movie. And I really like the last scene of this movie. We'll get into the plot. Like after they're apprehended, I'm like less.
I forgot how much of it was at the prison.
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought the prison was like 30 minutes, but it's like the whole second.
It's like half the movie.
When they're initially just like on the run, I think that there is something kind of fun about like subverting like the Bonnie and Clyde, Thelma and Louise. And it like really makes those movies. And Thelma and Louise is one of my favorite movies of all time, but it really makes Thelma and Louise look like predictable prestige. And I think that like there is something refreshing about the first act of this movie, just how it's like so fucking wild. Like that the whole scene that's introducing how they met, that's like basically making fun of and referencing Married with Children.
I was gonna say it had to have been kind of like a
Married with Children. It's exactly Married with Children. I think it's fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Because I think that like that scene is almost like deep reading that show, because it's really nothing that show isn't saying in the subtext. It's just saying the subtext out loud. I was so blown away with how into that whole segment of the movie that I thought that it could like sustain that. And I ultimately don't think it does, but I do think that, yeah, the ending's pretty cool.
I felt like parts of that were from like a visual standpoint and like aesthetically, like really interesting and funny. I don't know. There's this whole thing that kind of rubbed me the wrong way about like the cliche of like this, you know, this idea of like poor white people and like the incestual father who's just like raping his daughter. And like some of it felt so like cheap and easy. At the same time, it's like the movie's like not interested in psychologically evaluating the characters, but then it's also like, well, she's like this because the dad raped her and the mom just watches. And Woody Harrelson's like this because of his dad and blah, blah, blah. So it kind of
it
like,
wants to have its cake and like eat it too at the same time.
I know, but
like, isn't this so deep and like crazy? And it's like, well, no, this is pretty like surface level. And I do think that's soap opera scene or the sitcom scene like a laugh track is probably one of the best scenes, but it's like once you see that, you're like, okay, well, we can just end the movie now in a way.
Because I do think you're right, Max, that it is like capitalizing on something cheap, but I think that like what it is doing, and again, I hate to give Oliver Stone like any credit, is I actually think it's deep reading something that like if you watch Married with Children, like that is kind of in the text. The way that he like I think that like by making it housed in something familiar and making something ugly that we all admit is ugly, like even more insidious, like I don't think that it's cheap.
No, by,
like,
I think
taking
that's fair.
Something that we all admit is like disgusting, but then like taking it too far.
I think I just have like such a disdain for sitcoms in general or anything that has a laugh track.
Okay.
So it's like I said, it's in the like the text itself. So when something like that comes up, I'm like, I agree with all of this.
And I think it's
a good scene too.
And I think it's also a way to like not make the movie too much of poverty porn. Because I think if it was like set in a more realistic reality, then we would feel too empathetic for the characters. And I think that you kind of have to if he wants to make the movie that he wants to make, sort of feel nothing for them.
When I watched this movie in general, but that scene too, there's a deeply understand what's happening, but I feel completely detached, which like you said, is sometimes better than like the poverty porn, like Sean Baker. And I love Sean Baker, but you know, sometimes
like
you just
Precious.
Don't want, yeah, like it, yeah, exactly.
Sure,
you know,
sure, sure.
Worse offenders. You just don't really want to feel that. And I do appreciate that Natural Born Killers doesn't rub the audience's face in misery. I guess.
Yeah.
It's playing in the same sandbox,
but it
isn't going for misery. It's more going for like cartoonish exploitation.
Yes.
I think the things that it does that are cheap and cliched are the shit with the native people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think at one point it says like media is bad on his like forehead.
Yeah. And she's
or
like,
something.
You can't
it's like, dude,
kill
are
him.
You kidding me?
Even the worst people in this movie who die, like don't deserve it. So you don't really need to have like this like symbol for like goodness be like a Native American man.
And also that scene's trying to like do two things at once. Like there's this, like he's trying to like exorcise like Woody Harrelson's characters, like demons in this part. And at the same time, because it's like triggering this like PTSD flashback to his childhood, he like lashes out and like kills this dude. And then it's juxtaposing like these views of Western takeover or like manifest destiny.
Right.
But then also giving like sympathy to Mallory and Mickey.
Yeah.
It's just, Like,
and then you have to get reminded of that scene later on. They keep bringing it up as if it's like resonant. I do think snakes are scary. So
yeah, I can't watch most of that scene for.
Snakes be scary. And I do think that like the snake bite stuff was kind of cool. So it got covered up really quickly. But I was like, this is not good.
It's cool in like a trippy way. It's kind of visceral.
Yeah. But like, I do think it's kind of fucked up to like make like the brown people stuff like.
Trippy. Oh, no, I'm with you. I'm totally with you. I'm not saying I'm not praising it for that. For a dude who makes war movies, like that scene to me is like a war happening inside a man's mind. Besides that, it's not interesting to me. Like I'm with you in it being like insensitive. It seems like it's using like
but I mean,
American
like,
people to just put in some texture, but not really say that's much a good way.
Sure.
Hey, listen, we got tobacco, lots of tobacco. If you got any gas we can buy?
I don't think he speaks English, Mickey.
Yeah, push comes shove, we can snatch that donkey and ride on out of here.
My name is Mallory. This is Mickey.
Al. Kahosh McKenza.
We're not from here.
Arzan Nijonita. Indishin. It's kind of like the Twilight Zone or something.
I mean, talking about the original script, so it was written by Tarantino. This is at the time where he sold two screenplays that he did not direct, and that was kind of the last time he would ever do that with True
this
Romance
and
Natural Born
this
Killers.
This one and The Good One.
And The Good One. He has constantly praised True Romance. He loves Tony Scott. You obviously see his identity in both movies, more so with True Romance. I like that Tarantino is able to give credit where it's due and was basically with True Romance like, look, I'm glad that Tony Scott made that movie because he made it a Tony Scott movie. He didn't make it a Tarantino movie. Mm-hmm. And I respect that. He did a really great Rewatchables episode, I think a few years ago, where he talked about Unstoppable. And he talked a lot about his relationship with Tony Scott and True Romance. And it's really great. But yeah, then this movie comes out a year later and he basically disowned it. He gets a story by credit. He basically said that they took the script from him, they rewrote a bunch of it, which Oliver Stone has discredited. He basically was like, that's not true. There was like a war of words between them where Tarantino, I read a little bit of the script, the original Tarantino script. It's definitely more restrained. It's almost more told through the perspective of the media. I can see how it would definitely be like a very different movie. It reminded me of anything of, have you seen Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, Clooney's first movie?
Oh yeah. I love that movie. I thought he was going to be a better director.
Yeah, I think we all did. he did that in Good Night and Good Luck. And we were like, oh, wow. And then we were like, oh, what's Leatherheads?
Like, oh God, I guess Ben Affleck's better than you.
I really love Confessions. Mostly it's because it's an incredible Sam Rockwell performance, but also
it's really good.
I like what Clooney did with it, but it was written by Charlie Kaufman.
Julia Roberts performances.
Yeah. Charlie Kaufman wrote it and disowned it, basically was like, I hate everything that
Clooney did. I didn't know he disowned it.
Yeah, he hated what Clooney did with it. I think it's good.
Because it's like more conventional?
No, because I think it's very like stylistic in a way that reminded me of this, where he's trying out a lot of different like formats and filters. And so they felt kind of comparable to me with like two writers being like, this is not at all how I interpreted this. But at the same time too, it's like Tarantino wasn't at the level that he was at yet. And look, if you sell your screenplay, I understand like if you wrote something that was really meaningful and somebody completely misunderstood it, it looks bad on you too. So you're kind of want to distance yourself and be like, no, that is not the script that I wrote. That's not the story that I put out there. But at the same time too, like it is sometimes great to see a great director adapt a great writer's screenplay and see what they can do with it. Someone like David Fincher does a great job of that with The Social Network. But
like David Fincher keeps his style so consistent. I feel like this movie, its style is so inconsistent and all over the place. And maybe that's sort of.
But that's like almost the consistency of it.
I think that it's supposed to be pastiche.
Yeah, no, of course. But it goes from like black and white to anime to. Yeah, no, it's definitely like channel flipping. And they're like, like you said, like TikTok generation type shit. But like, and it is, it certainly is. But it almost feels like after a while, there's no rhyme or reason. Every edit's unpredictable.
I agree.
Every stylistic choice is unpredictable, which again makes the movie kind of engaging. We're like, what's going to happen next? But once you go every 5 minutes from black and white to a green or red filter to distortion to an anime to Dutch angles all the time to the camera spinning to like, the movie just doesn't stop, which sometimes is really fun. I like a visceral experience, but it's like, to what end?
Well, speaking of, I think Tony Scott actually perfects that later in his career. Yeah. And like, you can throw so much at the screen, but here it becomes so exhausting that, yeah, by the end, it's just, you're not, it, maybe in 1994, it wasn't as exhausting. Maybe you were enthralled by it because it felt visceral and new. It made me really, like you say, Courtney, like actually respect Tarantino's direction even more, because you see how effective the violence is in his movies when he does restrain himself for so long. So it's far more fucking effective, because here it's like, you can feel bad for some of the people that they're killing. You're like, yeah, this
guy didn't deserve it.
Sucks. Yeah. But by the end, it's so exhausting.
The pharmacist didn't deserve it. I mean, no one deserved it.
No,
of
course.
The pharmacist wouldn't make me sad.
Except for like Tommy Lee Jones and Tom Sizemore, who.
Oh, yeah.
We should talk about.
Those are fun.
God, Tom Sizemore had the whole market cornered for sleaze bags in the early 90s.
He really did.
When he goes to the crime scene of where Juliette Lewis kills the gas station attendant, when he sees her ass imprint on the car,
he's like turned on by it.
Yeah, he's like, no, that is the perfect ass.
Jesus fucking Christ.
I mean, that's funny.
Also, I love Juliette Lewis shooting that guy in the head and just saying, that's the worst fucking head I ever got.
Yeah, Juliette Lewis kicks fucking ass in this movie.
Okay, yeah, again, like everybody's so like in the pocket of what they were playing at this
Lewis.
Time.
I'd be fucking pissed that I wasn't on this poster that was in every dorm room.
Yeah, that's correct. It's like, I didn't even think about that, but fuck.
They really make it a Woody. If you were just to look at the poster and look at the marketing, it looks like a Woody Harrelson movie.
I mean, she's
movie.
Technically on the poster, but she's just in the reflection of the sunglasses.
Yeah, whatever. But,
no,
it's
I
like,
know.
Or hadn't she done more things?
No, I think Woody, because Woody, Woody was on Cheers, and then he did White Men Can't Jump.
Oh,
but
that
she's
was before
she's
this?
Totally like the beating heart of this movie. Like, if there's
Juliette
any
Lewis
humanistic
like,
quality, it's in her performance.
Yeah, she was coming
and
off
the native
Cape Fear.
Just kidding.
if he was in the movie longer, but
no,
know.
I mean, I think
when was isn't she in Gilbert Grape?
Oh, she is. Yeah.
She is. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So she was a bigger star in my personal bedroom in the 90s because I loved her.
Yeah, I mean, her and Woody are incredible.
Girl energy before it was like named. Yeah, and she's still great. I know she's a Scientologist, but like she's probably my, I think she's one of the better parts of that Yellow Jacket show. And that's only to say that Christina Ricci's also in it.
Yeah, there was just a specific kind of actress in that, like the Juliette Lewis's and the Christina Ricci's that like we don't really have a similar.
Parker Posey will never
Parker
have
Posey.
Another, we will
Brittany
never
Murphy
have
was
Parker.
Kind of the last strain of it.
The
and
last
we just
one,
never
Winona.
Got. Yeah, we just didn't really ever get that again. Kind of circling back a little bit. I know we're a little all over the place, but so is the movie. Mm-hmm. To just the idea of like what qualifies as like a successful satire and how do they endure? We're in like the middle of the parasitification of movies where it's like if Get Out had this huge effect on horror, now Parasite is kind of like giving us these class warfare satires that almost feel like
you liked The Menu a lot more than me. The more I sat with it, the more I just had to be like, I fucking don't like that movie.
I had
that's
a good
the problem
time
with like new satirical movies in general. Like just the more you sit with it.
I like Sorry to Bother You.
Like Sorry to Bother You, I didn't really like when I first saw it, but I did think about it more than some of the other movies because I do think it has actually really great ideas in it. And that's because
it has really nuts. At least people turn into fucking horses.
I haven't seen The Menu yet, but I hear it's pretty fun.
So. Look, I think The Menu is just more of like it's a fun time. It's a fun time at the movie.
I mean, for me personally,
I think it almost like irons them out too much. Like I think that like it's ultimately guilty of the thing that it's calling out, which is like caring about rich people, but the only people that you get to really know are the rich people, including the chef, who's at that point an elevated rich person. Maybe like the exception of the Major D character.
Yeah, it's kind of the combination of like Parasite and whatever Adam McKay is doing now and the effect that it's having on movies where like, again, like Triangle of Sadness, even though I know it's really on the nose, I had a good time. I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
It overstays its welcome, but it's funny. I'm sorry.
I enjoyed that too, but I do feel like movies, like satire movies in general are the movies that end up bringing up like the most conversation with people because whatever the movie is, people seem to have like wildly different interpretations or like feelings towards the movie. Both people could say like the satire is obvious, but some people might enjoy it more or less than a movie that's probably very similar to the one that they just like critiqued or, you know, like you might like The Menu, but not like Parasite. I mean, that's probably rare. But,
I have a question then.
Yeah.
Is White Lotus a satire?
Satire, yeah.
I would say it's
that's the best satire.
I think what's annoying about the stuff now
is that
it feels like it's a lot of wealthier people critiquing wealth, but they're kind of just hitting the basic surface notes of like it feels like the Spark Notes version of something like Parasite, where it's like you're just taking the most obvious points from it. I don't know, like Mark Mylod, who did The Menu, also directs for Succession, which I think is
and he directed a
incredibly
Rotten Rewind classic.
What's Your Number? He sure did.
What's Your Number? Starring Chris Evans and Anna Faris.
Succession obviously is, I think, a lot more effective as a satire. But yeah, I guess like in the 90s, yeah, it was more like we said, like The Natural Born Killers, Scream, To Die For. What were the other ones that were kind of in that? Because it was like the rise of like, oh, is TV rotting our brains? And
I mean, I think
Fight Club, Fight Club. Like Greg Araki. Like maybe his stuff wasn't fully
I think
fully
that's
satire,
more successful. Yeah,
no, I agree. Yeah, I'm a huge, huge fan of Greg Araki because he's such a humanist. Like you watch a movie like The Doom Generation, right? And it does a lot of things that Natural Born Killers does, but I think a much bigger success for one.
And The Living End, too. Yeah.
It's like 35 minutes shorter. And like the ending of the movie is just so powerful because you essentially spend 70 minutes like eating junk food and having a good time. And then it just blows you down. And it's like, this is actually what this movie is about. And you're like, holy
shit. My day to night look, the day I watched this movie, was watching this and then going to see The Menu. And like by comparison, The Menu is just like so clean. It's like it's almost like the thing that it is criticizing, like this sort of like tweezery cleanliness. And like it, listen, The Menu's more pleasant. I probably laughed more at The Menu. I probably like them about
Totally different. The Menu needed like a Yorgos Lanthimos behind the camera. It needed somebody with a better visual touch. Because Mark Mylod, even though he does good work on Succession, like he's a TV director. He directs like a TV show.
And you can feel that when you're watching a movie like that.
Judith Light is incredible in it. Honestly, Anna Taylor-Joy, that's maybe my least favorite performance of hers.
Well, she's kind of like a manic pixie cool girl in it. I was just like, what do I know about this girl except that she's hot and kind of cool and smokes
cigarettes. Yeah, she wears lace dresses and has like Doc Martens. Like,
I'll say this about Natural Born Killers. Like, if there are TV directors that make movies that feel like TV, Natural Born Killers is a movie about media and about TV, but it's completely cinematic. It's nothing. The closest thing that I can think to that's TV related would be like Adult Swim shows. You know, like I feel this movie almost like birthed that instant. Or like you watch something like Too Many Cooks. Yeah. Or like Ren and Stimpy, like just super cartoonish, outlandish violence. That
Too Many Cooks thing is like my nightmare.
Yeah. It's so cursed, right? It's so.
Yeah. Cursed. I mean, so many men like love that and they'll like bring it up on like date 7. And I'm just
That's a weird thing to bring up.
Is that because
now
you work in a restaurant? Like,
I don't know.
It's not like a fun time to have.
I'm just like, hey, you want to get high and watch Too Many Cooks? I don't like it. Or like, you know what's a great satire or whatever the fuck it is that Nathan for show.
You. Well, yeah, I think
and then his new show.
I think the best people that have like their finger on the pulse right now are like Nathan Fielder, Tim Heidecker, John Wilson, Tim Robinson. Like those guys have this understanding of culture right now, and they know how to like dissect it and kind of comment on it without it being really annoying.
Whoever's making the new Sex and the City managed to make an incredible satire of itself.
Satires now that are successful.
Veep was great.
Yeah, Veep was really funny. In the Loop is funny. I like Nightcrawler. I think it's...
I love Nightcrawler.
I was thinking about that movie too.
Yeah, I think Nightcrawler does a really great job. And I thought about it. Like, it's another movie that I didn't love the first time I saw it, but then it really grew on me.
We all know the best satire is Jojo Rabbit.
Fuck you, dude.
When you're in the presence, you're in the presence of like a really good satire, you're like so enveloped by the story that I question whether or not it's a satire because I'm so in it. I would actually say that the best satire of all time is Heathers.
Heathers is great. I think To Die For is incredible. Verhoeven and Carpenter have done some of the best like genre satire that we've ever had.
Okay.
Like Starship Troopers, RoboCop, They Live. I mean, these are all fucking incredible movies.
Those movies bring something like truly unique in terms of style, or like someone like John Wilson, even though his style is like very reserved, you know, the way he makes like documentaries, it fucks up the medium. Like you can safely say you've never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
I think the problem with like modern day satires is they're like too clean and too on the nose. Like go back to Natural Born Killers, even though like I'm not a huge fan of it, like I can safely say that it's so fucking insane. Like it feels like a punk DIY.
Yeah.
Like this has to be probably one of the most experimental mainstream movies I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Whether that's a success or not, like that's
I think if you put it in the context of the time that it came out, I think it would probably feel really alive and you would just feel really bowled over by it.
And I think it comes from a place that's not just pertaining to like 90s movies that came before it, but like shit like Tetsuo the Iron Man.
I like that movie.
I've never seen that. I want to see
that. I like that movie. Good one.
Shinya Sakamoto is an insane person. Like, he makes movies that are just all over the place. Also, like, what's that Melvin Van Peebles movie?
Oh, Sweet Sweet Bat.
Yeah, like that movie.
Or Black Dynamite.
No.
That's Marvin Peebles.
Sweet Sweet Bat. Yeah. Song.
Yeah, exactly. Like that movie is
Marvin
super experimental.
Marvin Van Peebles got like gonorrhea during the filming of that movie.
I mean, it makes sense. Sounds about right. Even someone like Wong Kar-wai, I can sort of see.
Yeah, like
that
how it's
here.
Like frenetic. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But at that point, I'm like, I'm giving
too much credit, but.
Yeah. At that point, I'm like.
I think it goes beyond just like the sort of 90s stuff that was happening prior. I think there is like a weirder sort of.
Well, I think there's a lot of movies that don't, like at the time, also can feel really annoying or feel almost too on the nose, but somehow become more and more, they feel more and more important as time goes on. Like movies that we talked about earlier in the podcast, like Gamer and Southland Tales, where you're just like, okay. At the time, I remember being, you know, with Southland Tales being like, what the fuck?
What the
is
fuck is this?
And now I watch it and I'm like, oh, this movie was so fucking ahead of the curve.
Yes.
That you didn't even realize it while watching it. Same with Jennifer's Body.
Yeah, that movie's awesome.
You know, like there's some great ones from that era. But yeah, like Gremlins 2 was a fun one we've talked about.
Gremlins 2 is incredible.
Have you guys seen the documentary, The Killing of America from 1981? No. It was directed by Paul Schrader's brother.
No. What? No, I've never even heard of this.
It's kind of like a snuff film because it just is comprised of like real footage of like people getting like shot or like interviews with like serial killers or like just like crazy.
So
I think I have heard of this actually. Yeah.
Yeah, and it takes like all this media footage that like is probably too gory to show on TV and like puts it into like a feature length film, and it's very scary.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's very exploitative. I think it was banned in America. It did really well in Japan for some reason. They like loved
actually,
it out
this
there.
Looks pretty sick.
Yeah, right. It's pretty crazy.
No, it
like,
looks pretty sick. Yeah,
the soundtrack is dope too. That is an interesting point to bring up, like Boys in the Hood, because I know Menace to Society came out in 1993, and I really love that movie. And obviously, it's like a cautionary tale and trying to humanize people in these situations, but. Yeah, Natural Born Killers, its targets are completely different. And it's not trying to be, I almost said it's not trying to be like a message movie. Obviously it is, but yeah.
It is trying to be a message movie, but I think that the word that you use that like I like is humanize. Like it never tries to humanize its character. That said, you do believe that they like deeply love each other, but in the most fucked up way. Like that really fucked up scene where they like kidnap a woman and he rapes her, but Juliette Lewis is getting jealous. I don't know if either one of you have like read much about the Ken and Barbie Killers. They're like two of the most.
Is that the ones that the Killers is based on?
I don't think so, because the Ken and Barbie Killers were like they were like upper crust attractive people, and they would abduct women. And a lot of the reason why they got away with it for so long was because like they seemed like a happy couple, and they didn't fit like the MO for and they ended up like killing her sister and stuff. But it was like the same sort of like mechanisms where they liked to kill together, but they also were like jealous and shit. It's one of the scariest stories. The woman is out of prison. She's changed the name and she has a baby. But again, she killed her sister.
Like a teacher now? Is it the Canadian couple?
Yeah, they were Canadian.
I believe she's a teacher now, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh my God. That is terrible. I'm sorry. Like, I do.
She's killing it in another way now.
Yeah, she's killing it.
That's a slight.
Well, with that scene in general, like, I know what you mean. I feel like the way it's presented, it doesn't really work. But there's something about them as a couple where they're so impassioned and so in love in the way that, like, people can be in love through things like jealousy or through things like rage
or because
or
of
things like, or because of
the rape scene is really upsetting, obviously. But the one that really works is when they do the impromptu wedding and then people are being too loud and he's like, I'm not gonna kill anyone today, it's our wedding.
I think
that is fucking funny.
But I think a lot of that's also indebted to those actors too, like
100%. Like, thank God you got these two people because they have chemistry and they're both just so good.
Also, I think that's also a Tarantino thing of like, he's very good at romanticizing characters like that and having them feel very like genuine in that way.
Yeah, taking the most like ridiculous, absurd characters and making them like likable, or like the way like Woody Harrelson delivers some lines is just like, the line doesn't even have to be funny, just the way he does
it.
I think Woody's just, I think like over the last like maybe 10 years, it's become like really clear, like, oh, this is just like one of our best actors. We kind of took for granted maybe for a little bit. I think he should have won for The Messenger. I think he's unbelievable. unbelievable in The Messenger. I know that there was no way he was going to win to Christoph Waltz in Inglourious Basterds, but he's incredible. I mean, even Three Billboards, which is a bad movie, he's very good in.
He's never bad.
No, he's great. I he's incredible in White Men.
He's amazing, and he's amazing in this. Yeah, he's like on my like top 10 list of actors that I feel like deserve an Academy Award. Also, like I do think that like everyone knows his biography, where like his dad was an actual like murderer in Texas.
Yeah.
And so I do think that like him being drawn to something, like I do think like he's giving something that's like there. Like when he's in a movie like this and a movie like,
he's great in No Country.
If anything, like his problem is that like he's in too many movies with too many good people. Like he's very giving.
He's so good in Rampart. That was one that he should have gotten more attention for.
My favorite is probably still White Man Can't Jump. And that's not to say that he hasn't like gotten better since then, but I love his character.
No, but that's a great movie. Performance. It's and he's also underrated for like his comedic abilities. Triple Nine is like not a great movie by any means. It's like a totally kind of fun, trashy crime thriller, but he's so good in it.
I hate those zombie movies, but he's really good in it.
He somehow straddles this thing of being like a very sort of like masculine macho figure, like a sort of just like everyday man who has like a chip on his shoulder, but can also show weakness. Like in True Detective, it's like the
he's so good,
but he's also like an in-between of like a leading man and someone that's like too caricaturey, like a Jeff Goldblum or Christopher Walken. He somehow is like never crossed over into doing Woody Harrelson.
He's a guy who I think is without a doubt going to get an Oscar at some point.
I think he's kind of hot too.
Yeah, no, Woody's got, because he's just got great, it's his whole fucking vibe and his charisma. Mm-hmm.
It's
his
vibe. Just got it.
You'll never understand, Wayne. You and me, we're not even the same species. I used to be you, then I evolved. From where you're standing, you're a man. From where I'm standing, you're an ape. You're not even an ape, you're a media person. Media is like the weather, only it's man-made weather. Murder? It's pure. You're the one made it impure. You're buying and selling the fear. You say why? Say, why bother?
With Tarantino, when he was talking about the movie, he was asked about the movie a few years, I guess, after it came out. And he said, I realized something that's helped diffuse my feelings about it. Oliver Stone, he's talking about Oliver Stone. He said, he wants you to know exactly where he's coming from, and his movies are making points and going for big emotions. He doesn't want ambiguity. He twists emotions entirely and he's hammering his nails in. He wants to make an impact. He wants to punch you in the face with this stuff. And when you leave the theater, he wants you to leave with a big idea. I'm more interested in telling the story. It's not better or worse in the grand scheme. It's just two completely different styles. When we were talking, he goes, you know, Quentin, you're like Brian De Palma or John Woo. You like making movies. You make movies and your characters are movie characters. I am making films. And it's true. I'm not into making films. That's such a backhanded thing to say. Like if
it is.
A guy who but bought my strip was saying that to me, I'd be like, what?
I also read somewhere that Johnny Cash really liked this movie and he told Quentin Tarantino that in an elevator, and that made Quentin Tarantino...
Oh, I'm sure like, that, yeah.
You know, someone that cool. I don't know. I also, like, for as much as I hate a couple, well, really just one Tarantino movie with, like a ton, I hate The Hateful Eight. Like, the older I get, the more I actually, like, really respect and, like, love his presence and, like, our cultural atmosphere. And maybe it's, like, getting to the age where so many people are just, like, dying left and right that I grew up with, where I just have to be like, you know what? Like, I fucking love this guy. Like, I don't love everything that he makes, but, like, I love that his opinion is, like, in the atmosphere that we live in today.
No, yeah, I mean, even when I disagree with him, which is quite frequently, like, he's just such a vital.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, he does cool shit. Like, he was the person that like made it so you could get a copy of Chungking Express in the States. So,
yeah, I mean, everything that he, especially in like the 90s and 2000s, like how much Asian cinema he brought to America just through like putting his name on it is incredible. It's the same thing with Scorsese. Like, he's just.
Yeah,
like,
I was going to say the same thing.
Of course, like
Scorsese seems more like a teddy bear, though. Like,
well, we know Scorsese's easier to love. Is
yeah, but just like his love for cinema and like trying to show people, or someone like Roger Ebert, who was such like a populist when it came to movies, just wanting to show people how you can get an in into these things that you normally would never experience otherwise.
Can we talk really briefly about Robert Downey Jr.?
Yeah, I was going to say, we have gone this long without talking about Robert Downey Jr.
My number one question is, does he have that accent so it can seem like lifestyles of the rich and famous.
I think it was supposed to be, I think the character is supposed to be like a Geraldo Rivera.
But Geraldo Rivera speaks.
No, I know. I don't know where I think the Australian accent is
supposed to be lifestyles of the rich and famous. Listen to it.
Well, it reminds me of that mixed with like a Las Vegas pickup artist type. You know how we have like Milo Yiannopoulos now? You're like, why is this person who's not even American concerned with this shit? Like a complete grifter, you know?
For sure. He's definitely a grifter. I mean, it's so funny too.
Is this pre Downey sober?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
he's
great
here.
He's on drugs. Oh, I think he's incredible. It's funny. I just watched his documentary Senior about his dad.
Ooh,
like the same day that I watched it. And it's great. It's so good. It's such a sweet, loving portrait of his father.
I wish
it's
he would really do more good. I would recommend it. Right,
it's like 90 minutes. It's on Netflix. It's really moving. And his dad was just so fucking cool. Downey here is so fucking funny. And just
he gets that. He's a Looney Tunes character.
Yeah, like, he's so unhinged. It's insane.
He's
is really unhinged, but the way that like Tommy Lee Jones is in his weird like Batman Forever mode where you're just like, what the fuck is... Like for an actor...
He's like Zorro in this.
So seriously. It's so funny to see him in performances like this where you're just like, what is going on?
It feels a little midlife crisis-y, this in Batman.
Yeah.
And now that he's like, I'm just going to be... Like this is his Corvette a little bit. Like I'm going to be in this really like edgelord movie.
There's not a lot of actors who can do what Tommy Lee Jones does in like this in Batman Forever. And like when he goes full gonzo mode versus like you see him in something like every time I rewatch In a Country for Old Men, I think he's just so good in it.
He's like, perfect. That the thing about Harrison is that like he was surrounded by too many cool performances and I don't think we were expecting Josh Brolin to be so captivating and then we didn't know Javier Bardem. So
right.
The person
Tommy Lee Jones
is
just like
Woody.
Yeah, it's just a performance that every time I see it, I'm just like, this is such a perfect performance. Everything that he's doing in every scene is just incredible. But it's fun to watch him here. Also, I don't know if you guys watched the director's cut. I didn't this time, but I've seen the director's cut. And in the director's
cut,
I believe it's 2.5 hours. Well, he had to cut 150 shots from this movie to avoid an NC-17 rating because they kept giving him an NC-17.
Yeah, I heard he removed about like 6 minutes of footage or something.
I'm honestly really shocked that it is an NC-17. Like this
movie
is
pretty
so
insane,
much.
Especially
I mean, it
for
does just show like how prude we are as a country. Like we are so inoculated when it comes to violence.
Well, Fight Club and The Matrix, this was the poster boy movie for like every conservative politician being like, this is what's wrong with our culture. Like Bob Dole like brought up this movie all the time on the campaign trail.
It's just like, bro, it's kind of proving
movie
the movie's
is
point.
What's wrong.
No, it is. It is. And it's so like,
it's like the poster of posters.
I do really love that final shot though of them in like a Winnebago.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I love the last scene with Downey.
Well, also apparently the scenes that were removed because of the NC-17 rating, from what I read, you know, it takes with a grain of salt. But what I heard was that the majority of the scenes revolved around the final like prison riot with Robert Downey Jr. killing a lot more people.
Yeah, also
that it was NC-17 was because they didn't want it to be like Robert Downey Jr. doing it, not necessarily like the violence that was going on.
That makes sense. Well,
it's funny because I didn't even realize, because I think I must have seen the director's cut when I first saw it as a teenager, because I vividly remember the shot of Tommy Lee Jones's decapitated head being carried around on a stick. Which is not in
the movie, right?
No. It's in the director's cut. Once they basically like rip his head off and put it on a spike and carry
it
around.
What happened to that prop?
But that actually makes sense given like the juxtaposition earlier from the Woody Harrell's like nightmare or dream where his like father has his head cut off. So that actually kind of works thematically. And I kind of wish they kept that in, especially because they already showed a dude who's decapitated. So like what?
It's because it's a famous person decapitated. But that's true. Like
that's true. Yeah. It's
stupid.
Like that almost like proves the movie's point a bit.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Like this movie is like a hologram to me that like we're in a safe space here. We can have like a conversation about it. But if I went to like work or was at a party and someone really liked it, I would judge them. And then I would also judge them if they did. If they were like, I saw the worst movie yesterday, I would do both things. Like where it's like the menu, I think is like as good as this movie, but I have stronger nose. Like,
I think
I have
it's different. Its
lines.
Ambitions aren't as high. Like the ambitions of this movie are so sky high.
And that's what bothers me about it. It's like, why didn't you try to be better?
So I guess Downey, there's an Australian TV shock reporter named Steve Dunleavy who did like Current Affair that I guess that he spent time with to get
the accent down.
My favorite moment of his is he has this little moment when they're setting up for the interview in the prison and there is a black inmate who's just sweeping, who's doing like janitorial work, and then Downey's just like, what are you in here for? And then the guy just goes murder like under his breath, and then Downey just goes, I'm with you, man, and just hugs him. It's like, I'm here for you.
which is so hilarious because like later on, like when they're having that interview, he's like, you know, you're sort of a monster. You've murdered people. He's like, and Woody Harrelson's like, and you're innocent. He's like, oh, I'm totally innocent. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
I'm an innocent man. Never done anything wrong.
Yeah. And then I guess the soundtrack for this movie was produced by Trent Reznor.
Really? Well, isn't there a Rage Against the Machine song that comes out when
there's a Rage Against the Machine? Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it killing in the name of or something?
Yeah. The one.
It's one of the funniest music choices I've ever heard.
Yeah. It's really goofy. They use that one Nine Inch Nails song like a lot. What is it? Like Something That I'll Never Be or something. It's a really good song, but they use it a few times in the movie.
It's like a soundtrack that I would never listen to that I really thought fit.
I remember seeing, like, again, like, I remember growing up seeing the movie poster and seeing the soundtrack a lot, mm-hmm. like, seeing mm-hmm. it everywhere.
Yeah, like, if you bought CDs back in the day, you'd buy, like, a soundtrack CD. I remember my brother had,
yeah,
it was some movie that had a Slipknot song on it.
I wonder what that was.
Yeah.
Or was like, it Dracula 2000? It might
have
been Scream
3. Yeah. Or it might have been Scream 3. The Scream 3 soundtrack.
Scream 3 is unhinged.
Scream 3 is yeah. like, that's the one that Creed wrote an original song for.
I need to hear that now.
What if
Scream 3 we have to cover? We'll cover really Scream have to cover. Three. Yeah, there is a Slipknot song on Scream 3 soundtrack.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It's called Wait and Bleed.
Yep.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
My guess. You text your brother, but my guess is it's fucking Scream 3 because I had
no,
Scream.
No, it definitely is. I was gonna say Scream, but I was like, that doesn't.
No. The Scream 1
soundtrack is fucking. And
you can kind of
two.
Track our cultural movement.
Yeah,
soundtracks because the first Scream soundtrack is like
Nick Cave is like, and then
kind of like 90s
alt weird. Like there's like the eel that Perfect Day in Hell song.
It has eels, but it also has an incredible D'Angelo song, and then it also has a Cottonmouth King song.
I forgot about Cottonmouth King.
That's the first time I ever heard Cottonmouth King because it plays in the scene where Jamie Kennedy is killed.
Oh, damn. Okay.
Which is insane. So I'll always associate Cottonmouth Kings with that.
But then by the time you get to Scream 3, we're looking at Creed.
We're in the new metal. That's the new metal Scream.
Slipknot, Symptom of a Down.
Yep.
Seven Dust. Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, that power, it was in the Dracula
Power
2000.
Man 5, were you about to say Power Man 5000?
Yeah, they're on the Dracula 2000 soundtrack.
We're getting deep here.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there anything else we want to touch on before we wrap up and go to
Creed? I just want to say shout out to Woody Harrelson during the scene where Tom Sizemore is threatening to cut Juliette Lewis's tits off. Like he really showed us that he didn't want that to happen.
Yes. Scene. Yeah. Fuck the house that Jack built. Okay.
Yeah.
Woody Harrelson came like, through.
Damn. Oh, he's like really upset.
Oh, I also do love when Tom Sizemore is trying to fuck Juliette Lewis in her cell before they kill him. Mm-hmm. And she's like, what do you want me to do? And he wants her to like pinch his nipples. And Juliette Lewis just goes, you're so specific. Like, what?
You can tell that, like, even though he's giving some level of like emotionality to mm-hmm. her, like, he just wants to have sex with her. He doesn't give a fuck at all.
Well, I think that it does the thing that, like, honestly, like, the people who sat on the Ken and Barbie murder trials, like, did, where they automatically assume that the woman is more innocent.
We didn't talk about it, but this is based on a real couple. So this was based on a couple in the 19, it was in the 60s. It was a guy who was basically like a loser who was bullied, who really wanted to be James Dean. So he dressed up like James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause. He fell in love with this girl that was much younger than her and then basically killed her family. And they lived in the house with her dead family for a few days and then went on the run and killed a bunch of people. But when they got arrested, she said that he had kidnapped her and she didn't kill anybody. And then he kept saying, no, she wanted to do all this, and it went back and forth, and eventually he was executed and she was released, I think like 13 years later or something like that, on parole, and then like changed her whole like identity. And so it is based on a real couple. There was a lot of copycat murders that came after this movie. There were murder victims' families who tried to sue Warner Brothers and Oliver Stone because I guess there was a couple that went on a killing spree and they had a Natural Born Killers poster in their room.
Well, this movie is like the perfect embodiment of this bizarre middle ground where you get into these conversations, whether it's video games or like Marilyn Manson, movies in general, where it's like this is simultaneously condemning or like showing you what this violence truly is, or like, you know, the brutal dark truth of it all, but then also it does inspire, you know, some level of copycat. I mean, this goes back
to
Rebel Without a Cause or Taxi Driver, or you the conversation's kind of moot, but it just falls in this like sort of both things are true at the same time.
Yeah,
I think that we've gotten now almost like post this, where I think that like one of the scariest stories for me that has like existed in the last 5 years. It's like those young kids that never had met but were dating, and she like he was suicidal.
And convinced him to kill himself. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like now HBO I actually almost like post this moment where it's like it almost feels quaint. But it's almost the same thing. Don't you think that those people's like brains would have clung on to something? Like it's not
to something.
Thing.
Oh, no, of course. Yeah. That's the thing. There like, would have been something.
Fucking
to
Marilyn
it.
Or Charles Manson blamed the Beatles, you know. Yeah.
I think it's
and Charles Manson was MK Ultra, so
he was MK Ultra.
Boom.
I do believe that. Did you read Chaos?
No, I haven't yet, but I've
it's
heard
an incredible book.
It.
Definitely read it. It's great. Kind of by the end of it, you're like, this actually makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately,
all this is adding up.
Wait, that he like worked for the CIA?
That he was a CIA plant. That basically he worked for the CIA. They employed him, were feeding him LSD and having him basically distribute it to see the effects that it would have on people. And then it led to that. Not saying that they ordered him to kill Sharon T, but this was basically like a, I would highly recommend like, the book Chaos.
We
it's
made
an
a monster.
Incredible book.
Yeah.
It's a great fucking read. You will blow through it. I know you don't read a lot of nonfiction, but it's
so it's like nonfiction-ish. It's speculative.
It's based on a lot of evidence and interviews over the years. This guy, Tom something, I forget his name, he researched it for like fucking 25 years. He spent so much time
on
it.
Okay, yeah, I'll read that.
It's an incredible book.
So he speculates that Charles Manson was a CIA agent.
That he that basically was a CIA
plant.
And
then released into society eventually, and then he became a murderer.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff there. Yeah, I think just like in summation too, like, I think going back to like the satire thing, it kind of goes into like, I don't even know how you can make a really effective satire at this point because of how much exposure we have to media all the time, 24 hours a day, that there's no, we're already, we move through these cycles of experiencing something and then either criticizing it or laughing at it or lampooning it, whatever it is, like so much quicker that I don't think that you can get to a point where like you can have a successful movie that, you know, I'm not saying that you can't, but I think it's harder to find something that like touches on the zeitgeist and can capture the mood through satire the way that you maybe used to be able to.
Everything that's like reactionary right now moves so fast that it could be seen as completely hypocritical in the next year because you didn't have enough information on it.
Exactly.
You're just basing like a reaction off pure emotion.
Yeah. Okay, and I do think I deserve an award for not bringing up Buffy yet. But that said, I do think that like every good satire should be able to like function as the thing that it's satirizing. I think Scream is probably the Scream and Buffy and Heather's, in my opinion, are the three best at doing that. Because like Heather's is still just a teen movie. Scream is still just a horror movie. And Buffy is still just a teen show. And I think that that's what's lacking now. And I think this like still has, like it's still a crime movie. And I kind of have to respect it for that.
I would absolutely add RoboCop to that too, because that's a movie that goes over its target audience's head until they really analyze it. But you can choose to kind of watch it either way. Like Verhoeven was just so fucking good at that. And same with Carpenter.
Yeah, it's nice to see like satirical movies that are still trying to have fun.
I guess that's the thing with The Menu. It's like, it's really not a fun movie. It wants to be fun.
I don't
it's
know. I had fun with it.
I didn't have that much fun. It was very
I'm sorry. I'm an easy target. It's if you're talking about
a
kitchen staff
target.
Murdering a bunch of rich people, I'm probably going to be on board.
What do you guys think of like exploitation movies where they end up killing like innocent people or people like that don't deserve it, like whether it's like Maniac Cop or like those movies are like really dark, right? Because like there's no real justice and like it doesn't matter who you are, you're just gonna like get
I don't care. That's fine with me if it's well done.
Yeah,
I'd
rather have that than something that thinks that its ducks are in line and it turns out to be mad.
Yeah,
it's trying to
well,
be
I think it's the McKay thing is just like there's a smugness to it. This movie, I think, with Natural Born Killers, because of who Stone is, it borders occasionally on him spouting these really obvious talking points of just like
it's high and low at the same time. Like you were saying that he's a rich kid but went to Vietnam. It seems like a person made this movie who was in both, had their feet in like both doors.
Yeah,
it's a bit high and low at the same time, I'd say.
The first movie we ever talked about on this podcast, Bamboozled, I still think is one of the best satires.
Oh,
a movie that
true.
has endured that a lot of people really hated at the time and thought was really blatantly on the nose and way too obvious. And you watch it now and you're like, oh no, this is like actually maybe too restrained, if anything.
Hi, Dad, how was work?
What work? I'm unemployed. Where the f*** have you been, huh?
Well, you look nice, Mallory.
Yuck, you look like...
Thanks, Mom. Well, I'm gonna go now. I'll be back at midnight, okay?
What are you wearing, a broomstick and a trash bag? Why don't you put some meat on you, huh? A few pounds lighter, you'll be Miss Ethiopia. How the hell do you think you're going, huh?
I'm going to the John Lee Hooker concert with Donna. I told you that yesterday.
First off, you don't tell me anything. You ask my permission. Second, you're not going out in that hula house dress. You'll end up peddling your ass, you stupid bitch. And third, you're not going out at all. You didn't mow the yard.
This movie has a lower than I thought. It has a 48%. I'm surprised it has not gone
up. Me too.
Up,
I thought it'd be
time.
Like a 50s.
But it does have an 81% audience score. Rolling Stone gave this movie an F and said it was the worst movie of 1994.
Wow.
Stone calls this bile satire, but satire takes careful aim. Killers is crushingly scattershot. By putting virtuoso technique at the service of lazy thinking, Stone turns his film into the demon he wants to mock. Cruelty as entertainment. I mean, I understand that.
Mm-hmm. I agree with the first part, but maybe not the second part. I do think that there's like something like fun by being like this. They get to live and then they get to be a typical American family. And like this country is a country that has like been built on like slave labor and sure. just like us like pillaging people. So I do think that like that final scene of them like being wholesome and in a Winnebago is what we all do. Well, me less so than you two every day living in this country on like stolen land. And sure. like, I think,
well, I mean, I think that's like, tight. Yeah, like that's their rehabilitation. And like, and it's funny how Scream does that like 2 years later with being like with their whole motive and this kind of meta reflection of a movie's impact on them and how they're going to rehabilitate themselves through their trial, because that's mm-hmm. what they'll find. That's where they'll become the best.
I mean, listen, Scream is a perfect film. I think Absolutely. It's in my top 10 films ever made. So it's like, yeah, of course, Scream is a better movie. But I do disagree with like the final note of that review. I do agree that it's a fucking scattershot.
I agree with this one to a degree. James Bardinelli Realview said, as a satire on the media's infatuation with violence and murders, Natural Born Killers hits the bullseye. The problem is this is a one-note movie. It repeatedly hammers home the same point until the audience is bludgeoned into senselessness.
Yeah, that's the thing about this movie. Like, the things that I like and the things that I dislike just cancel each other out.
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of people felt that, where it was, even the critics that really hated it recognized how, again, like how groundbreaking it was, how visually inventive it was for a studio movie. The Christian Science Monitor, they said,
well,
the irony of the picture is the fact that Stone's visual imagination is tremendously impressive here. It is one of Hollywood's most stylistically adventurous films ever. What a pity its brilliant ideas are expended on a failed satire with little but rage on its agenda. The Wall Street Journal said, a brilliant mess, I suppose, in the way that seriously disturbed people can sometimes deliver a briefly mesmerizing vision of the universe while babbling. If nothing else, Natural Born Killers is the most in-your-face movie ever released by a major Hollywood studio.
Yeah, that last sentence, I think, really rings true. A brilliant mess, I suppose.
I suppose. I guess. Yeah, some more mixed and positive reviews, though. TV Guide magazine called it wildly unconventional, corrosively satirical, savagely violent, and vulgar. The Austin Chronicle said, the opening sequence is surely one of the most brilliant establishing sequences of all time. LA Times said, Natural Born Killers is both audacious and astonishing, a vision of a charnel house apocalypse that comes close to defying description. And finally, Roger Ebert gave this an A and said it was one of the best films of 1994. He loved it. That checks out. Yeah, Roger Ebert said, like all good satirists, he knows that too much realism will weaken his effect. He lets you know he's making a comedy. There's an over-the-top exuberance to the intricate cross-cut editing and to the hyperactive camera. Yeah, I mean,
that she didn't get her tits cut off.
Oh, they could have showed a titty. Robert Richardson really shoots the shit out of this movie. I mean, he's really doing some crazy work here. It's crazy that I don't know if anyone has seen the trailer for the new Will Smith slave movie, Emancipation.
I sure haven't.
It's crazy that Robert Richardson shot it because it looks like shit.
Color grading just in the trailer, I was like, what is this?
That and Women Talking. I'm like, why do these movies
I thought when I
saw
the
trailer
for Women
Talking was a bad book.
About,
oh, shit. Like, I'm sorry. I was thinking of a different book.
Oh.
That book is good. I'm so sorry. Cut that out.
I thought you were just talking about Women Talking in general. I was like,
No. Women Talking. Okay, wait, the three.
Women
three
Talk.
Women
Talk.
Like, what's the one that's like four women, six women? That one was like kind of like just a shitty book. No, Women Talking is a good book. I didn't know they adapted this.
Sarah Polly.
Unadaptable.
Sarah Polly adapted it. And apparently they were just like, why is there like a village filled with women who are apparently illiterate having these really verbose, like well-spoken arguments about sexism?
Sometimes they just got it, bro.
That does not seem like a movie that should be a movie.
It doesn't look good. Both those movies look like parodies of Oscar movies.
Oh, that's too bad.
Oh yeah, but I did see when I saw the trailer Together for Emancipation the other night in a theater. There's a shot at the end of the trailer where it just cuts to his back and it shows like the whip scars in his back. And it's a shot of that. And this woman in the audience just goes, oh,
like she wasn't expecting it.
Yeah, she's, oh,
what was that? What did they do?
No. Who's everyone's MVP?
It's hard.
It's a hard MVP.
I'd say Juliet Lewis for me.
Okay.
Yeah, I love her in this.
I'm kind of torn between Woody, Downey, and Robert Richardson. You're saying Rodney Dangerfield?
No, I do. I really love Rodney Dangerfield.
Let's not forget about Steve Wright, too.
Oh, that's right.
Because okay. I think this movie needed me to laugh in the second half when I was less interested, I'm going to give it to Downey.
Downey's really funny. Yeah, I guess I might just go for Downey. Also because I just miss Downey doing like
me too. I'm just like why stop being Tony Stark and then start being Dr. Doolittle?
Oh, he's doing a new Shane Black movie.
Okay. Honestly, great. Mm-hmm. No, I always wonder is like, you know, he was like an addict and he lost Sarah Jessica Parker. I if I was Sarah Jessica Parker, I would always be like, he was like the one that she had to let get away. Now she just married a Matthew Broderick. She
married to a fucking guy who was accused of vehicular manslaughter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like she's married to like a way worse actor, way less charming, way less handsome, probably a worse person, but just like clean.
I've heard Downey's a really actually like great guy. Final rating?
This is the meaning of a train wreck.
But it also does seem
is
like
a cult classic.
No. It's like it's setting, it's doing what it's setting out. It's accomplishing what it's setting out to do. Whether I like
that or not. I
love
a train wreck. I don't think it is at the, like, I think that it does have this dull middle section that kind of like fumbles what it's trying to do. So I think it's a train wreck.
I don't know what Natural Born Killers is in a way.
It's completely American. I can say that.
But I mean, it is like a cult classic.
It's our new category. This is the new.
It's American out of 10.
This is America.
This is America. Yeah, that's the statement. That's best critique ever.
If you want to watch Natural Born Killers, it's on Netflix, which is fun. Next week, we're going to be doing our final Tony Scott double feature of the year. We've been really going hard on Tony. We're going to be closing out with Man on Fire and Domino. We also want to give a very special thank you to our Patreon subscribers. Because if you're listening to this, you're listening on Patreon, including our guest today.
Yeah.
Alex, thank you. Alex, where can remind people where they can find you?
On Letterboxd, my name's Alex Kolpan, K-O-L-P-A-N. I'm also on Instagram. My handle is Young Grown Ass Man.
That's right. He is a young grown ass man. That is
young spelled the normal way?
No, it's Y-U-N-G.
That's
right.
See,
you really...
Yeah, I'm really nailing it tonight.
Yeah.
This guy.
Yeah.
This is our young grown ass man. Shout out to young grown ass man. That's how we should introduce you every time.
I have
Wait, are you
film.
A young grown ass man?
Or, no, no.
You know what I mean?
I'm young, I'm growing, and I love ass.
That is true. Ass. That is true. I can attest to that. But yeah.
It can be both. You can have both.
You're like Tom Sizemore. That's the perfect ass.
Hopefully perfect by next summer, I'll have a little booty pop going. So, but
okay.
More movies with cops investigating crime scenes and saying, that's a perfect ass.
Yeah, it's a great ass.
We do want to give a special shout out to our top contributing patrons. We could not do this without you. So Victoria Kruger, Andrea Ferris, the one known as ASR. We don't know your real name, but we thank you so much. We love you, you anonymous person that is so kind to us. Ben Beakey, Devin Hanson, Ben. Hi, Ben. Jean Yonarel, Constance Carino, Graham Redman, Jeff Raposh, Neil Fuller, Matt Hayes, as we talked about, Brody Anderson, and Jade Yankowski. Thank you so much. I will do my best. And if I have butchered your name, I want you to send us a message and say, you fucking idiot. Thank you to all those people. Thank you so goddamn much. We have a few more weeks left of our Vulgar Auteurism series that we will be finishing up. As we said next week, Man on Fire and Domino. We'll also be having a Crank double feature bonus episode for those lucky subscribers. And make sure to tell your friends. Thank you for listening.
You make this all go away. You make this all go away. I'm down to just one thing, and I'm starting to scare myself. You make this all go away. You make this all